was wondering if the role could tell us about the legitimacy of dynastic succession outside of Moses, especially as it applies to rabbinic dynasties.
Yeah, it is a discussion. The Gemara itself indicates that if all things are equal, this is very important, if all things are equal, a son should succeed his father. But that absolutely only applies if you have two candidates who are otherwise equal, meaning to say that in positions of Torah, it should always be the greatness of the person individually that counts. So in things like Rabbanos and things like Rosh Yeshiva, nepotism technically should not play a role. And in the real world, you know, we don't always live up to that standard. Now, Hasidic dynasties might be a little different, because there, Hasidic leadership is a very difficult thing. Certainly, being learned in Torah is part of it, but it's not only. There's also organizational ability, there's charismatic ability, there's elements of Ruach HaKodesh, and some of that, you know, may be connected to the Zechus of Avos as well. So there may be more of an argument in the Hasidic movement for dynastic succession, simply because there's kind of a mystical power that goes from generation to generation. But we find, you know, we certainly, and we find in Chazal as well, for example, the Nesias of the Sanhedrin was Ben Achar Ben from Hillel, really for 400 years. On the other hand, in a way, that was kind of a unique break, because before Hillel and after, you know, in other words, it was not always hereditary. They used to choose a different Nasi all the time. From Hillel's time onward, they went hereditary. So all I can tell you is there is a tshuva from the Chazam Sefer who does say, Lahalacha, if the son is as worthy as anyone else, he should get the position, but you don't automatically do that. So in the world as we have it, hereditary succession is abused. It's not. It's applied beyond where it should be applied.
I was wondering if the Rav could tell us a little bit about what is taught in seminaries, and the extension of that question is regarding halakhas. I've always been taught that, you know, I mean, of course, both men and women need to know halakha. We often learn it through, well, right now in the lower shears through Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and the upper shears through what, Mishnah Berurah, Shulchan Aruch, etc. What is learned in seminaries?
Well, first of all, the diversity in seminaries is actually greater than the diversity in yeshivas, meaning to say that almost all yeshivas are kind of the same. Seminaries are very different, so it's harder to even generalize about seminaries. But large are very, very excellent institutions. You know, it's a very funny thing. In some of the more modern seminaries, or not seminaries, but more modern girls' schools, you know, they want to make it more like yeshiva where they do Gemara. I sometimes think, you know, instead of trying to make a seminary like a yeshiva, we ought to try to make a yeshiva like a seminary. I mean, seminaries have a better educational system. The problem we have in the yeshiva world, and it is both a problem and a blessing, of course, is Gemara. Gemara, as you know, is the yisod of Torah Shebal Peh. There's no question about it. Gemara is the foundation of understanding halacha. Otherwise, halacha is just a bunch of rules. And first of all, if you don't know the basis for it, it's impossible to memorize. How many rules can a person memorize? You know, a million, you know, rules. And second of all, if you don't know the basis of it, you're not going to know how to apply it to the millions in the first case. Even if you memorize, let's say you memorize like the whole Shulchan Aruch, if you don't really understand the basis for it, you're not going to know how to apply it to any other case. So we need Gemara. Gemara is the foundation. But the problem is, as you know, Gemara is an extremely labor, if I can use a more modern term, an extremely labor-intensive subject. By that I mean, if you just did Gemara an hour a day, you know, you couldn't learn how to learn it. In other words, it takes a real long time to get the language down. It takes a real long time to understand the conceptual thinking. It takes a real long time till you become self-sufficient. So as a result, we have to spend hours and hours and hours on Gemara, just so you guys in the center, after 2 years, have what is called a basic proficiency. It is the 800-pound or the 2,000-pound elephant, so to speak. Now, the problem with that, although obviously every moment you're learning is infinitely precious, of course it is, but the problem with that is it crowds out everything else. The problem is that it means there's really no time significantly for chumash, there is no time for detailed halacha, there is no time for organized hashkafa, kind of Jewish philosophy, Jewish thought. So we have little courses, little shiurim here and there, little bit of pockets, but we have no time to address it with depth and in comprehensive. Now, the seminaries, being freed from Gemara, to focus on those other things. So if you went into a seminary, right? Or maybe a Kadosh Baruch Hu sending me a message not to say anything negative about the yeshiva's time. But if you went into a seminary, you know, you could actually get, you know, a whole course, you know, on the Book of Yirmiyahu, the Book of Malachim, etc., Jewish history, philosophy, Hasidus, all sorts of many, many things that are very, very interesting and very important parts of Torah, which they can do precisely because they don't have the hours and hours and hours that we need for Gemara. So I remember I was at a Shabbos meal once, and you know, a bunch of guys from Brisk. Brisk is a very, as you know, very, very high level. Right? Brisk is like the elites. Like the Harvard or the MIT, you know, of the yeshiva world. And the guys were talking, and somebody raised the question, well, you guys don't know any halakha, you don't learn any halakha, you know, how do you know how to paskin? So they say, well, we'll just ask our wives when we get married. We don't have to know halakha. You know. And it was said as a joke, but it's not totally far from the truth. There's some truth to that as well. So the question becomes an honest question, and that is, so what do you do? Should we cut down on Gemara? Should we bring in, you know, more of these other things? Well, that's a tremendous loss, because to become a Talmud Chacham, there is no question you need to know Gemara. And the theory of the yeshiva world is, once we give you the tools to know Gemara, you can then learn halacha and everything else on your own. Which may be true, but kind of you never get to that level. To kind of say, well, we don't have to do any of this because you could do it on your own. Well, okay, but not everybody will do it on their own, and the like. So we really have a dilemma. It's simply a dilemma. Now, do we reduce Gemara? Then we're not going to be able to produce people that are really Talmidei Chachamim. Do we keep the Gemara? But then people will be ignorant of these other areas of the Torah. Should we create different tracks? This is a suggestion that's been made. In other words, for those who are going to become the big lamdanim, you know, we do Gemara Be'in, and for other people, we give them, you know, more of a diversity. But then you run into the issue of labeling and stigmatization and trying to predict, like it's kind of the old vocational schools they used to have in the old high schools. I don't think they do it today, but in public high schools, there used to be the concept that there was the intellectual track that was pre-college, and then there's kind of the carpentry track stuff for the people who are not college material, you know, who'll teach you how to fix cars and things like that. But once again, I mean, you're labeling people, and there's kind of a connotation of this is the inferior remedial track, although not really. To be able to fix a car, it takes at least as much raw intelligence as it does to be a lawyer. I mean, there's no question. But be it as it may, we do stigmatize blue-collar things. So it is a dilemma, that's all I'm telling you. It's a real shaila that anyone that's involved in creating a yeshiva really has to face. And whatever solution you do, you're going to lose, because the Torah is infinite. The Torah is infinite. And there are so many aspects of Torah that it is impossible for us to be able to cover these things. I will say that in an ideal world, we would follow Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos is Chazal. And what Chazal say is exactly what is right. Pirkei Avos talks about starting at 5 years old, and for 5 years, all you learn is Tanakh, from 5 to 10. And then from 10 to 15, you learn Mishnah. So by the time you start Gemara, you know, you have Mashach and mastery of Mishnayos, at least on that level. And then when you learn Gemara, it's a much faster process, because how much of our time in Gemara is spent trying to figure out what a Mishnah says, what a Braisa says? If you already knew all of that stuff ahead of time, then the ebb and flow of a Shakla Vitaria would be so much better. Now, the problem is, and that's what they do in the so-called Zilberman system, which is a fantastic, fantastic chinuch system here in Eretz Yisrael, Zilberman. And in fact, I cannot even understand why it is not universally adopted.
Is that a school?
It is a school, yeah. It's a system of schools. It's a system of schools where they don't even begin learning Gemara until they're 15. But one of Rabbi Pinderus's sons-in-law, which means a lot of his grandchildren, are enrolled in the system. And they just, they know Mishnayos by heart, they know Chumash by heart, and they understand it. Now, the problem with implementing that system for older people is, we just don't have time. I mean, if you say you're coming to Or Samech for 20 years, give us 20 years. Okay. So let's do 5 years of Tanakh and then 5 years of Mishnah, and then we'll have 10 good years of Gemara. Well, that's wonderful, sign on the dotted line. But, realistically, you're not going to be here for 20 years. So as a result, we've got to jumpstart you, and we have to figure out what can we give you that you might be less able to do by yourself. And the answer is Gemara, because theoretically, the other things you can possibly do by yourself, to get proficiency in Gemara by yourself would almost be impossible. So as a result, there are trade-offs, and I'm just telling you the difficulties of this. So in many, many ways, get married to a good seminary person, and you can learn from each other. You can be the Talmud Chacham of the house, and she can be the Posek, or the Posekas, etc. And once again, that's Azer Kenegdo. Each one can help the other person. I know a person who says also an interesting thing, that he has a great netiyah, a great desire to learn Chassidus. And the Hasidus he likes is Rav Tzadok. Rav Tzadok of Lublin is a very, very deep sefer. But there are beautiful, beautiful things. But it's Kabbalistic and it's very hard to wade through it. So he says, he takes his wife's Pri Tzadok and she underlines all the good ones, so to speak. So he says he's able to do that without having to wade through a whole bunch of things that are less accessible. He says, so he learns it on his own, but since she had to do all of it or whatever it is, he's able to follow, what she chose. So all I'm saying is that this is a problem, and it's a real problem, and you understand that Rashi Yeshivas tried to do the best for the Talmidim. Having said all that, I would still submit, except of creating different types of shiurim for different types of people is still a good idea, even though it runs the risk of labeling. To a little degree, a stickle degree, we have it in the Beis Medrash here, where you have a Pindrus, let's say, who learns more halacha lemaisa mesechtes, right? So that's it is technically an alternative track, although it's not fundamentally that different. Yeah.
So I was curious about goyim and their obligation to understand the seven Noahide laws. They seem to all be preventative. So I was wondering if the best path of them really is the Eastern religions, say it's a forego all physicality. Monks, that they forgot all these things, destroy.
Well, I tell you, Eastern religions are great, except for the Avodah Zarah aspect. You run into a little problem there. You are correct, though. It's very, very interesting that, it's a well-known idea that Judaism is not an ascetic religion. Judaism does not preach that the world is evil, and it does not, although you'll have Makoros, but generally speaking, the overall philosophical attitude we have is that the Rambam espouses, based on the Gemara, that the Nazir is a sinner, right? The Nazir has to bring a korban after Naziris because he is forbidding himself from legitimate pleasure. We believe, enjoy the world, but don't let the world control you. Eat and drink, be merry, you don't have to be poor, but use your resources for tzedakah, serve Hashem, right, etc. So as a result, we do reject asceticism. We do reject separation from the world, as long as you don't get overly consumed by the world. Control the world, don't let the Gashmias control you. You're more than yourself. Now, there is, however, a makar in Chazal that because Goyim don't have the Koach of Torah, they have less of the ability to elevate the physical. And the way they connect to God is by separating. And thus, the instinct of the Catholic Church, in theory, that celibacy is the preferred route of holiness, is totally against Judaism. But the Torah might actually recognize that for a non-Jew, it might have a certain preferred route. Now, the proof that I want to give you is the following. You know that non-Jews are allowed to bring korbanos in the Beis HaMikdash. That's the halacha. A non-Jew can bring a korban, but the only korban a non-Jew is allowed to bring in the Beis HaMikdash is a korban ola, and not a korban shlamim. What is the difference between a korban ola and a korban shlamim? A korban ola is totally burnt on the mizbeach, totally given to God. A shlamim, burnt on the mizbeach, part of it is eaten by the Kohen, part of it is eaten by the Israel. So in the Svarim, this is a halacha, this is a halacha in the Gemara, and the Gemara has psukim to derive it. But conceptually, what it might be teaching is that the path of holiness that the non-Jew has is the path of renunciation, the ola, give it all to God. The Jew is able to eat and drink and be merry, and still consecrate them and dedicate it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, as I say, Eastern religions have a very, very deep spiritual message. There is no question. And in fact, there are makoros that they actually come from Avraham Avinu. If you remember the verse, Avraham Avinu, after Sarah died, had children from the concubines, from Keturah rather, and it's Keturah is Hagar, she did tshuva, she became a righteous woman, and it says, he sent them away and gave them gifts. So according to some interpretation, it is the wisdom of the East. Right? So we claim, so not only is Judaism the foundation of Islam and Christianity, although I'm not sure if we're so proud of that, but Judaism might well be the foundation of Eastern religions as well. And there's no question that there is deep, deep spirituality in it. But the problem is that over the course of time, it has gotten linked to images and other types of worship, which makes it idolatry, at least some forms of it, and that, of course, is in itself a violation of the Noahide Code. But you do know, I don't know if you know this, that 9 out of 10 Western converts to Buddhism are Jews. 9 out of 10. So if you have an English-speaking Buddhist, the probabilities are overwhelming that they are Jewish. Now, you could say that that is extremely upsetting, that chas v'shalom, so many yidden are turning to this. But I see a certain positive message to it, because those who are seeking Eastern religions are seekers of spirituality. They want to remove themselves from the decadence and materialism and selfishness and egotism of modern society. They are spiritual seekers. They think that Judaism doesn't offer spirituality. It's very interesting. There are people who think that Judaism itself is a materialistic, money-grubbing religion which has no spiritual content, because that is the Judaism they have been exposed to. And we can say, well, I agree with you. You're, in other words, the Judaism you're rejecting is the Judaism I reject too. Right? Just like you tell the atheist, the God you don't believe in is the same God I don't believe in. In other words, your idea of God that you reject, I might reject it as well. So the hope is that when you have a neshama that is seeking God, even if they go the wrong way, there is a passion for truth, and that passion for truth can make them wonderful, wonderful Bali Shiva, if we just show them the way. In a way, they may even be better than the people who are even religious Jews, but who don't think about God and don't think about Rukhnis and just go with the flow. These are people that are really trying to find a way. So, as I say, your point is a good point, except for the Abba Hazara point, which, of course, is a very, very serious, serious issue.
Is there a problem with the Abba Hazara if it's based on their tradition?
Yes, it is a problem. I mean, one of the Noahide laws, again, the first of the Noahide laws is to believe in one God and not worship Avodah Zarah. Right? So that's the first one. Which is why, even if a non-Jew, you know, keeps morally, doesn't kill, doesn't steal, if he doesn't have that belief in God, he is in violation of God's will for all of the Noahide people.
Just a question about if there was a source for concept of Das Torah, and to which rabbis would it apply, and to what topics, what would be included, and what type of worship is applied to everything?
Yeah. So let me just explain this a little bit. Das Torah is a popular phrase. It was not commonly used till around World War II. And what it normally means is that we consult, or people consult, great rabbis or great gedolim, that has to be defined as well. Not only on matters of halacha, is this mutter or is this usher, but on matters of politics, you know, should we give up land for peace? How should we deal with the coalitions in the Knesset, etc.? Should we let the boys go to the army or not go to the army, etc.? In other words, now, it is said that the concept of Das Torah is one of the main dividing lines between the Haredi worlds and what you might call the modern Orthodox worlds. The modern Orthodox world tends to view rabbis as technicians, as plumbers. You know, I ask my plumber how to fix a clogged pipe. I ask my rabbi, what if my milchik spoon falls into the fleshik pot? Rabbis are plumbers. They happen to have education in one particular area, so I will ask them about that. But I'm certainly not going to ask the rabbi about what type of woman I should marry or where I should educate my children, etc., because, you know, the rabbi may not be an expert in that. This is kind of the modern Orthodox perspective. Again, I'm generalizing. There are many exceptions, which views the rabbi as a glorified technician, but beyond the technical aspects of halacha, particular makom. In the Haredi world, this includes the Hasidic world, the Yeshivish world, you know, all these different worlds. By the way, the use of the term Haredi world, I want to mention a little piece of trivial. We never used to describe American people in America Haredi. That was never a term. It's interesting. Now, if you talk about American Haredim, that's totally new. We used to talk about Yeshivish and Hasidish. So Haredi is an Eretz Yisrael import or export that is now used for Americans, Canadians, South Africans, etc. It's a totally new thing. It's less than 10 years old. We would never describe a yeshivish person in America as Haredi. But be it as it may, so this is a big dividing line, but I think that the yeshivish or Haredi or Hasidish response is the following. Torah, learning Torah, doing mitzvahs, does not simply give you a certain body of knowledge. It connects you to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You are closer to God. And if a person is closer to God, their wisdom and their insight and their understanding is going to be deeper. And even if you're learning Bava Kamma, and Bava Kamma has nothing to do with the draft, and has nothing to do with politics, and nothing to do with all of these other areas. So you might say, well, how is knowing Bava Metzia or Bava Kamma relevant to issues of life? But the short answer is, when you are mekuriv to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you insight. The Vilna Gaon called it a form of Ruach HaKodesh. Sometimes there is miraculous Ruach HaKodesh, but even if there's not miraculous Ruach HaKodesh, there is depth and there is insight that comes from years of learning Torah, and not just learning Torah, but the years of righteousness, of mitzvot, of kedusha, of working and striving to serve Hashem. So Das Torah, although it's a relatively recent phrase, is based on the metaphysical idea that a person who devoted himself to doing the will of Hashem will have a deeper and higher wisdom and insight than people who did not devote themselves to that same degree. And therefore, when a gadol, I'll try to address who is a gadol, when a gadol advises you in a certain mahalach, then even if it doesn't make that much sense to us, we have to believe it is coming from a higher place. Because if we don't, we are denying the holiness of Torah, and we're simply looking at Torah as an information base. And then we say, well, this is within its information base, that is not within its information base. If you believe Torah is a connection to Hashem, then it's a totally different thing. That is the philosophical basis of Das Torah. Now the question becomes, and that's why you find, and this sometimes is a source of consternation, when a gadol is machlit something, he will not always give you a makor. He will not always tell you, oh, this is based on Shulchan Aruch and so and so. This is based on Gemara, so and so. The Chazon Ish says that Das Torah is a fifth chelet of Shulchan Aruch. There's only four, right? It's a fifth chelet, because it emerges from the Torah personality and consciousness of how a person looks at the world. And in fact, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman used to say the following words, even in halacha. You know that when Rishonim, like the Rush or the Ramban, when they bring a halacha, sometimes they'll say, the halacha is so-and-so, and this is the proof. And they'll bring a proof. And sometimes they'll say, Nirali, it appears to me that this is the halakha. So if you ask yourself, which is a stronger halakha, the one that is based on a proof or the one that's based on Nirali? So we might assume that a halakha that is based on Nirali is a strong, I'm sorry, the halakha based on a proof is stronger because it has a proof. But Yosef Lanter used to say the other way around. When a halakha is based on a proof, all you have is one proof. When the Gadol says Nirali, it is coming from the totality of all of the Torah that he learns. And it actually is more stronger, more powerful. Now, having said that, I do want to point out that many, many Gedolim, maybe less so in Eretz Yisrael, but certainly Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, they did recognize that they would not express opinions on many matters that required a very detailed factual analysis. So, for example, land for peace. When they said it's mutter if it would alleviate security, and then they would be asked, well, does it or doesn't it? They said, that's not for us to decide. You have to talk to generals and politicians. So a gadol normally takes a great responsibility not to answer questions specifically that someone else... For example, if you somehow got a meeting with Chaim Kanievsky, and, you know, you'd probably get 3 minutes, and you would ask him, should I marry this woman? He would not tell you yes or no. He would tell you to go to somebody who knows you better. Same thing with what karusa should I have, etc. Meaning, a gadol, das Torah, should normally be employed for general guidance. But for the specific questions you have, it is actually better to go to somebody who knows you better. Should be a Rebbe, should be a Talmud Chacham, should be somebody who is makusher to the gadol. But you know, you don't need the greatest gadol to answer your question. I mean, that's why we have hierarchies and the chavrusas, right? I mean, do you want as a chavrusa, you know, the gadol hador? Maybe not. You know, the gadol hador might not be the best chavrusa for you. He might be go a little fast. He might assume knowledge that, you know, we don't have yet. Right? It's not always so pushing that you need the absolute best in a situation. So the point basically is that Das Torah does not preempt the need to consult with lesser figures. And I would add something even more. Das Torah, at least in the Litvisha tradition, does not dispense with the need for you to cultivate individual judgment. The goal of a Ben Torah is not that every single question I have to go to a Rosh Hashiva and get an answer. The goal is to internalize a value system, to internalize a hashgacha, so that you develop the capacity to know how to be a husband, how to be a father, how to develop, you know, your learning in a good way, to do mitzvos. Because if you have not developed those capacities within you, there is something wrong in the chinuch. And a good Rebbe and a good yeshiva is not designed to create a constant dependence like, you know, an umbilical cord. It's designed to give you a sense of independence. Now, when unusually difficult shilas come up, then of course you still need to be able to, all of us need to be able to consult with our Rebbeim. But it should not be an umbilical cord like dependence. In fact, that might be the difference in Hasidim and not Hasidim. Hasidim, again, I'm generalizing here, tended to cultivate more of a dependence on the Rebbe. In the Litvisha tradition, the non-Hasidic tradition, independence was greatly, greatly valued. And I want to point out, in Chabad, it's a very funny thing. Chabad, you might consider almost the paradigm of total dependence on the Rebbe, even after the Rebbe's death, with letters and the like. But if you go back to the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, the founder of the Chabad Shalshelet, the founder of the Chabad dynasty, his point was exactly the opposite. He actually wrote in his igros, in his letters, he told Hasidim not to ask him questions about business, about Parnassa. They should figure those things out themselves. He was there to be a resource only in Hadracha, in Avodas Hashem. Right? So actually it was a Hasidus that was very much based on independence. And of course, I should say too that in spite of all the dependence on the Rebbe, Chabad Shaluchim do have to. I mean, they're put in environments where they have to exercise a great deal of independence. Like, how do you start a place in India or Thailand or whatever it is? Obviously, these are young people that that have enormous independent judgment. Bekitzer, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, again, once said a wonderful thing. He said, Chassidim and Misnagdim are both wrong. Misnagdim think they don't need a Rebbe, and Chassidim think they have a Rebbe for all questions. And they're both wrong. Misnagdim need to be connected to a Rebbe, and Chassidim need to know that you have to be a little disconnected from a Rebbe as well to find that that thing in the in the in the middle. Now, which Gedolim do you say Das Torah? So all I can answer is this. There is no magic line that says, oh, these are Das Torah Gedolim, and these are not Das Torah Gedolim. It's simply based on this idea. The more a person is devoted to Avodas Hashem, and the more he has worked on himself, and the more he has purified his midos, and I want to emphasize that as well, the closer he is to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So all I can tell you is, when you find people who, in your judgment, now you're not going to always know, but based on what you can see, seem to be people who have worked on themselves, and people who have been selfless and devoted, you know, devoted to Hashem. These are the people that are more likely to have Das Torah. That's all I can tell you. So you have to make the judgment as to where you will find them. Why don't you first? I'm ready.
Says in this Mishnah in other places that Hashem offered the Torah first to the sons of Esav and the sons of Ishmael, and they rejected it because it says you can't kill and you can't steal and stuff. But aren't these goyim also obligated by the seven laws? So what's the ready statement on this?
That's a very excellent question, because the very mitzvot that they said they cannot do because it's too hard for them, these were the very mitzvahs that they're bound with under the seven commandments of Noah. Part of the interpretation is this, though. Part of the interpretation is that the Noahide code does not have a whole Torah Shabbat Peh that interprets it. To some degree, the society is given a certain definitional autonomy under Noahide law that they would not have under Halakha. So it's not so much that they couldn't accept the concept of murder or the concept of theft, but they didn't want to accept the Torah Shebal Peh that precisely defined it in great, great detail. It's like a person saying, I'm willing to accept the Torah Shebichsav without the Torah Shebal Peh, because there's more freedom there. So that would be the chisarin there, because the Noahide societies are given a certain... It's not totally unrestrained. There is a little bit of a mistake as to the meaning of these commandments as well. For example, abortion. You know, a Noahide society would not be permitted to permit abortion, because abortion is clearly prohibited under the Noahide code as well, and it's even more chumar, because abortion for Jews is not murder, mamish. Abortion under Noahide law is murder, but still, there's much less Torah Shabbat Peh. And in fact, we find that dichotomy even by Klal Yisrael. Because, you know, there's a famous question. On one hand, the Jewish people said, Nasa v'nishma, we accept the Torah willingly, but there's a Gemara in Megillah and in Shabbos that says, God held a mountain over our heads and said, if you accept the Torah, that's good. If not, I'm going to crush you. So, were we forced into it, or did we accept it willingly? Tosos asks the question. But the Medrash Tanchuma says, Nasa v'nishma goes on Torah shebichsav. We accepted Torah Shebichsav willingly, we had to be forced into accepting Torah Shebichsav. So I'm suggesting the same idea might be true for the Noahites.
I'm wondering if there's any way that a Jew could like lose his status of being Jewish and be like completely cut off, and Tshuva wouldn't even help, and he would almost like theoretically be putter from mitzvahs, like he would just like deconvert, so to speak. Is there any status of designation?
Well, the Rambam says the following. The Rambam actually writes, and not everybody agrees with the Rambam. The Rambam writes, and this would unfortunately encompass a huge number of Jews, that a Jew who does not believe in the 13 principles of faith is cut off from the Jewish people. and is not regarded as a Jew. But you have to understand a few things. Number one, however, even the Rambam makes it absolutely clear that there is no such thing as being cut off from tshuva. Meaning, no matter what a person did, a person can always do tshuva. Now, the Rambam admits that a person may be so addicted to averos that it'll be difficult for him to do tshuva, but there is a possibility of tshuva. Also, it is impossible that the Rambam means that if I don't believe in the 13 principles, I'm putter, I don't have to keep mitzvahs. In other words, it means I'm not presently a member of the Jewish people, but I'm still mechuyev to become a member of the Jewish people. So the Rambam does say there is a category of Jew who has cut himself off from the Jewish people that we don't regard him presently as a member of the community, but there's no way he can convert out of Judaism. In fact, even if he converted to Judaism, he cannot convert out. Judaism is a one-way sliding door. We let you in. Once you're in, you have no way of getting out. By the way, that creates a very, very difficult cross-cultural problem, because Islam has the same rule. So this creates a real problem when you have a Muslim converts to Judaism. First of all, because Judaism, his life is in danger. That's a different question. There are some who do, but it's mamish pikuach nefesh. But the problem basically is that Muslims continue to consider him Islamic. We consider him Jewish. And the same thing is true, Rahmano Litzlan, in the opposite case. Now, there are particularly young women. There are young women, chilonim, or chiloniyot, who have married, even in Israel, who have married Muslims and live in Arab villages. And they had underwent a Muslim conversion process. And there's an organization, Yad Liachim, that tries to get these women back. But in the eyes of Islam, once they converted to Islam, they are regarded as Muslims. So you do have that issue. But nevertheless, from our perspective, you cannot not be Jewish. In fact, there was an interesting court case many, many years ago in the 1960s, which involved the Israeli secular law that is called the Law of Return. You know the Law of Return. That is actually the very first law that the State of Israel passed in 1948, that every person who is a halachic Jew is entitled to automatic citizenship in the State of Israel. So the case involved a man, Brother Daniel, who was a Jew who converted to Catholicism. And he did not identify himself as a Jew at all. He identified himself as a Catholic. Was he entitled to citizenship under the Law of Return since he no longer considered himself Jewish? And I believe that, this is an interesting thing, that he was not entitled to citizenship under the Law of Return because he repudiated his connection to the Jewish people. Now, why he wanted to live in Israel is an interesting question, but nevertheless. Now, what's interesting is, this is a rare example of Medinat Yisrael being more machmir than halacha. Because all of a sudden, we have the secular Supreme Court of Israel saying, you're not Jewish because you turned your back on the Jewish people. Halacha would say, sure he's Jewish. Of course he's Jewish. Just because he became a Catholic, he's doing a big Aveira, but he's Jewish. Right? So halachically, he's 100% Jewish.
They held the Rambam.
Huh? The problem is they don't hold of the Yikrim themselves, but okay. Now, there is, however, I do want to point out, there is, however, a minority sheet in halacha that says, a minority position, that says that when a person converted to Christianity, his wife doesn't need a get. He now becomes a goy, and his wife is free from marriage without a get. There actually was such a shita. So you do have that view, but nevertheless, we don't follow it. If I could tell you, although it's a Sereshim Echuba, I shouldn't interrupt this with jokes, but I have to tell you a little joke. It's very funny. About a fellow, he was working for a Polish nobleman. And the Polish nobleman was anti-Semitic. He was making fun of him. He was saying, you stupid Jew, crazy Jew. But he said, I admire you. You're smart. Why don't you just convert to Christianity? I'll give you a double raise. Then we'll be fine. You'll live like a rich man. So all of this pressure, relentless pressure and abuse, month after month, year after year, he finally converts. He says to his wife, listen, I can't take it, and he converts. So the next morning, you know, he gets up in the morning, and before he goes to work, he starts putting on his tefillin. So his wife says to him, what are you doing? You converted yesterday. So he just says, oh, I have a geisha cup, you know. Okay, in other words, I forgot. I don't have the Jewish intelligence anymore. But okay. But the point is, I'm pointing out, there is a makar in halacha that a mummer's kitchen is not valid. But we do not pass them that way. Yeah.
I don't know if there is or happens there isn't much of an importance to identifying the Shvatim now, since in the Torah it made it clear that it segregated everybody and it was really important to Hashem, but now all we know is calling them Leviim based on the Torah, but everything else we kind of put on the wayside.
That's correct. Well, it is spiritually very important, but we just don't have the ability. It's one of the costs of Golus is that we don't have a sense of tribal identification. So I've mentioned a number of times the teaching of the Arizal, that the yesod of different nuschais of tefillah comes that each tribe had its own nusach. There were 13 gates to the Beis HaMikdash. Each tribe had its gate, and if you didn't know you had a 13th gate, each tribe had its nusach. And the Ari claimed Nusach Ari was the Shar HaKolel that would get you in no matter what. So it is an avla. It is a very big avla. But nevertheless, until Mashiach comes, we are not going to be able to definitively identify. Now, there are people who do know. For example, it is well known that the Maharal's family is direct descendants of Malchus Beis David. Now, the Maharal lived in the 1500s, and there are many people who can trace themselves to the Maharal. You know, you're from Shevet Yehuda, you know, if you're Malchus Beis David. There are individual people that have yichus that goes back that way. For most of us, it's really impossible to know. But the answer is Hashem. When Mashiach comes, we will know our tribes. Yeah.
It seems to me like each generation cannot possibly be spiritually higher than the preceding generation due to the fact that each generation is one link further away from Mount Sinai.
Yep.
Is that the case?
That by and large is the case. However, I do want to make a point. When we say Niskatnu HaDoyrus, the Doyrus get inferior, that doesn't mean every single person of an earlier generation was greater than every single person of a later generation. I mean, we're not going to say, for example, that every single Jew that was alive in the Chafetz Chaim's time was greater than Rebbe Elyashiv. You know, we're not going to say that. In other words, it's only like equal, meaning Gedolim, etc. But yes, by and large, it is true that as we are further and further from Matan Torah, we are further and further from having a sense of that connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
Why did Hashem set up the system such that the ceiling, the limit, as you know, regarding the level a person could attain, would necessarily go down with each generation?
Well, the concept basically is that it's like a bomb, right? You have ground zero, and the further and further geographically you are from the bomb, the less intense is the hashpa. But I think HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to emphasize the importance of Mesorah, because if you had the idea that each generation would be better than the other generations, then we would not turn to our parents, we would not turn to our rabbis, we would not turn to our predecessors for guidance. This creates a system where connection to the totality of our past is essential, because they have so much more of it than we have. And the truth of the matter is, in truth, Niskatnu HaDoros is not only in Torah knowledge. As I indicated a moment ago, it's entirely possible that a given person in this generation may know more Torah than another person in the other generation. I mean, it's entirely possible. There were Amoratsim in Europe too who didn't know. But you have to understand that Niskatnu HaDoros is not only a question of Torah knowledge, it is a question of Yiras Shamayim, it's a question of depth of Emunah. For example, if you met even a simple European cobbler, you know, who may, you know, maybe you know even more, although maybe it's not likely, because even the simple people knew quite a lot, but even if you had more Torah knowledge than them, but you would just see a certain Yiras Hashem, a certain sincerity, a certain devotion, a certain kavana in the way they done it. things were very, very different in a society that was less materialistic and less decadent, right? So the Niskatno Adaras can be seen on many, many levels, not just knowledge. There's also a question of spirituality and Yirat Shamayim and a commitment to values.
It seems like the bracha is passed from man to man. It seems like there's patrilineal descent. Today, we have patrilineal descent that one Jew is a Jew and some other Jew. So when did that...
Yeah, this is a very important. This is actually a very important issue. The Ramban says in the Chumash that Kaidem Matan Torah, before Matan Torah, Yichus was determined totally from the father, and this was not only true for Shvatim, what tribe you belong to, which is always the case. This was even true for Jew versus Goy, and in fact, vis-a-vis nations of the world, that's still the halach. In other words, if you have whether somebody is from Ammon or somebody is from some other nation, that's determined by the father. The only thing that is matrilineal based is Jew and Goy. And the Ramban says, Kaidem Matan Torah, everything was based on the father. Matan Torah created the din of matrilineal descent. So when the Reform Movement makes the claim that patrilineal descent was the original rule, and it was changed in the days of Ezra. So they do have a point that patrilineal descent was the original rule, but they're off by 1,000 years or so. We believe that it was Mischadesh by Hashem at Matan Torah. In fact, the Ramban says very beautifully, this was the halachic question. Do you remember the Torah records a story that the son of an Egyptian man and a Jewish woman blasphemed, cursed God, and they didn't know what punishment they should do to such a person, and they put him in jail, and Moshe had to ask Hashem what the halacha was, and the halacha was, if one blasphemes God, one is stoned. Ramban says, the shiloh was the following, they didn't know, should they paskin he's a goy, because his father was a goy, and the pre-Matan Torah law was patrilineal, and he was born before Matan Torah. The question is grandfather clause, basically, meaning he was born before Matan Torah from a non-Jewish father and a Jewish mother. Should we apply the pre-Matan Torah law and goy, or should we apply the post-Matan Torah law and he's a Jew? Now, the reason why that's important is cursing Hashem is a violation of the Noahide law as well. So either way, he's going to die. But the Noahide punishment is decapitation. The Jewish punishment is stoning. The Ramban says, this is a Lumdus Ramban, the Ramban says, the Lumdus is, given the fact that Matan Torah changed the definition of Judaism from patrilineal based to matrilineal based, how does that apply to people who were born from a non-Jewish mother before Matan Torah and committed a sin after Matan Torah? Do I apply the pre-Matan Torah rule, in which case they would be Jewish and their punishment would be stoning? Or do I apply the post-Matan Torah rule, in which case they're not Jewish and their punishment would be decapitation? That's exactly what the Ramban says, so that would be the answer to that question. Yeah.
I heard the other day that some say that the Ramban may have, Chas v'Shalom, been forced to convert to Islam based in his life, from where he lived.
Totally untrue. Absolutely untrue.
I was supposed to ask it by someone.
I will tell you, I just want to tell you, I don't want to mention people by name because of perhaps Lashon Hara, but I will tell you that in Christian Europe, during the Crusades, and of course they did this because of fear of their life, there were children of great, great, great gedolim, great, phenomenally great gedolim, who did convert to Christianity. So unfortunately, it is part of our legacy and part of our Masorah that such things did happen occasionally. But
my question was, would it affect the credibility of the Torah of someone on a Khazar if they converted or?
Well, Well, it would certainly throw into question if Chas v'Shalom, if you were able to prove to me 100% conclusively that such things happened, it would certainly diminish the Rambam as a source of authority, but it wouldn't automatically mean everything he said is untrue. I mean, basically, the Rambam gave his teachings, and you have to remember that the Rambam's teachings were mekubal by generations of Gedolim. So it's not just, you see, it's not just the Rambam telling me something. It is hundreds and hundreds of years of Gedolei Torah. Now, in a sense, therefore, I would have to say that the truth of the Rambam's assertions do not fall or stand on the Rambam as an individual. It falls and stands on the collective judgment of thousands and thousands of great, great rabbis. So unless you tell me they all converted, I don't think it would affect the truth of the Rambam. I will tell you another thing, too. It's interesting that there were times, as I say, it's very rare that Jews converted to Islam for whatever reason. But the conversions I'm aware of that did happen, sometimes of eminent people or children of eminent people, tended to be conversions to Christianity. And conversion to Islam is almost unknown. Yeah.
Well, what's the controversy about the present principles of faith come from? What's the controversy about the present principles of faith?
Well. Here is the thing. You know, the Rambam did articulate 13 principles of faith, but the problem is that some of those principles were not agreed upon by all the Rishonim, meaning to say there are Rishonim that deny certain things. Now, it's very unlikely that these great Rishonim would be Apikorsim, so to speak. So, while some of the Rambam's principles are, of course, you know, I mean, there's no Rishon that denies there is a God, you know, so to speak. But, you know, so some principles, you know, you're not going to argue with. But other Rishonim, whether God has a body, there is machlokas about that. Now, everyone admits that God is omnipotent, all-powerful, that God is not subject to death. No, that's for sure. But some have been willing to admit the possibility of a corporeal entity of God. And when the Torah keeps on telling you, if you did not see an image, that means God did not show you an image, but that doesn't mean God could not assume an image. So the point basically is, on some of the details, it's not as clear-cut as one would assume. Even things like every word of the Torah was said by God. Now again, I'm walking on very, very thin ice here. There are some that take the position that even though every mitzvah comes from God, but some of the wording may have been formulated by Moshe Rabbeinu, etc. The Ibn Ezra says such things. So, as an absolute halakha psuka, you can find many, many arguments on details of the Rambam's 13 principles. Once again, I go back to what I said, though, that the consensus of Gedolah has been that these are all fundamental principles. I had mentioned, I think, before Rosh Hashanah, Rabbi Yosef Alba, who was a great Jewish philosopher, who lived around 200 years after the Rambam, he basically says, instead of there being 13 principles, he says there are only 3 principles that Jew has to believe in. One is there's a God. 2, there is reward for good and punishment for evil. And 3, Torah comes from heaven. Everything else are details. So whether there's Olam Haba, Moshiach, Tchias HaMesim, those are details, and you can argue about them, as long as you believe in some system of reward and punishment. This was Rav Yosef Alba, and the book that he wrote is a very important book that's still learnt, called Sefer HaIkarim, the Book of Fundamentals. Now, people misunderstand what Rav Alba was doing. Does Rav Alba mean he doesn't believe in Mashiach? Of course he believes in Mashiach, but he's simply saying, if I didn't believe, in other words, he's differentiating between what you call a mistaken belief and a heretical belief. According to the Rambam, let's assume, according to the Rambam, I believe in Olam Haba. I believe that when I die, my soul goes to Olam Haba, but I don't believe in physical resurrection. According to the Rambam, I would be classified as an apikoris and a heretic, and unless I did tshuva, I would not have a share in the world to come. That's what the Rambam would say. According to Rav Alba, I would be classified as a fool that is making a mistake But as long as I believe in ultimate reward and punishment, I would not be a heretic. So Rav Albo is not disputing the Rambam's teachings. This is very important that you get this. But he's disputing the characterization of those teachings as determining whether you're a heretic or not. So Rav Albo says a person can have many mistaken beliefs. For example, sometimes in the Reform movement, they talk about the messianic concept as a messianic era. They don't believe in a personal Mashiach, but they sometimes talk about the world will come to some state of peace or whatever. Again, according to the Rambam, that is heresy, kefira, ein lo chelek liolam haba. According to Rav Albo, it is a mistaken and foolish belief, but it is not a heretical. Do you see the difference in emphasis? Yeah.
So, I heard that Yom Kippur is Shabbos, the Shabbos Shavasim. I was wondering if there's any connection between that happening on Shabbos. It was like somehow...
Yeah, they're very, very special. First of all, interesting question. People ask me this, and actually a 10-year-old kid asked me this a few years ago, and it's a very, very good question. You know, you always ask people, what is holier, Yom Kippur or Shabbos? So everybody always says, well, Yom Kippur is holier, because Yom Kippur is called the Shabbos of Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbosot. But there are two questions about that. Question number one is, if I do malacha on Yom Kippur, I'm chayiv karesh, meaning God could cause me to die early, but a beis din cannot kill me. If you're mechalel Shabbos, there's misas beis din. Misas beis din is more chamor than karesh. That's question number one. Question number two is, how many aliyahs do you have to have on Shabbos?
Seven.
How many aliyahs Yom Kippur?
Six.
And that's the hierarchy, right? Shabbos 7, Yom Kippur 6, Yom Tov 5, Chol HaMoed Rosh Chodesh 4, regular Monday and Thursday 3. So based on aliyahs, it's pretty clear Shabbos has a higher rank than Yom Kippur. Right? So in reality, it actually seems that Shabbos is holier than Yom Kippur. And the reference to Yom Kippur being the Shabbos of Shabbos is not referring to holiness, actually. It's referring to the notion of Shabbos is refraining. So on Shabbos, I refrain from malacha. On Yom Kippur, I not only refrain from malacha, I refrain from eating and drinking. So it's the refraining, it's not holiness, the refraining of the refraining. Oh, they're totally different idea. It's referring to what are you resting from. You are resting from eating and drinking as well as malacha. So therefore, intrinsically, something to remember, Shabbos is the holiest. Now granted, Yom Kippur has something special Shabbos doesn't have, namely forgiveness of sin. But in terms of ultimate Kedusha, Shabbos might even be holier than Yom Kippur, and that's what the aliyahs seem to indicate. Now, when Yom Kippur falls on Shabbos, therefore, it's an amazing thing. We don't think about it, but how much holiness can be compacted into time. The day of forgiveness with the day of the creation of the world. The Kiddush is very, very awesome. Ad Kedei Kach, and I should have mentioned this when I spoke Shabbos Shuvah. Now, I mentioned Shabbos Shuvah, the Rambam, that says at the end of Perek Aleph Mehilchas Shuvah, that for the Aveira of Chilul Hashem, there is no atonement until death. I don't know if you learned that or you heard it. Right, the Rambam says, Chilul Hashem is such a severe Aveira that even if I do tshuva, and even if I have Yom Kippur, and even if I have suffering in life, I am not, I don't receive full forgiveness till death. That's a very, very awesome thing. I didn't mention, but I should have, this is new, that it's brought down in Sifrei Kabbalah that when Yom Kippur falls out on Shabbos, there is even a kapara for Chilul Hashem. And so this year you get a bit of a bonus in that way. But all I can say is that obviously it's a heightened level of even forgiveness when Yom Kippur falls out of
Shabbos. So then how can there be a sin that only atones to death when there's going to be a Yom Kippur that happens on Shabbos?
That's a very excellent question. Unless it just means that somebody dies before he said that Yom Kippur, meaning he commits the Chilul Hashem, and the next five Yom Kippurs, it's not on Shabbos or whatever. You're correct. In a lot of cases, they'll do that. That is true. Yeah.
Okay.
I was wondering why we don't mention the Korbanos for Rosh Chodesh in the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah, this is an old Machlokas Rishayim, actually. Well, we do mention it obliquely. We say Milvad besides the Korbanos of Rosh Chodesh. Right? We do mention Rosh Chodesh. Rabbeinu Tam had a disciple, Rabbeinu Meshulam. And Rabbeinu Meshulam took the position, Mamish, that there was no korban for Rosh Chodesh on Rosh Hashanah because the korban of Rosh Hashanah, you know, since the first of the year is also the first of the month, the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah covered Rosh Chodesh. Mamish, he took the halakhic position, there was no korban Rosh Chodesh on Rosh Hashanah. Well, this elicited a response from Rabbeinu Tam that is one of the most vituperative responses. You have to read these letters. I mean, Rabbeinu Tam like wanted to put Rav Meshulam in Cheirim. He said, you're going to be excommunicated. He says, you know, you're doing whatever. Rabbeinu Tam was extremely upset, and he said, it's a Dover Pashutz, that there were Korbanos of Rosh Hashanah and Korbanos of Rosh Chodesh. But here is the concept. The concept basically is that since Rosh Hashanah is a Yom Tov and Rosh Chodesh is not a Yom Tov, to mention Rosh Chodesh together with Rosh Hashanah would be disrespectful to the holiness of the Yom Tov. And therefore, we do refer to Rosh Chodesh in an indirect way, but we don't explicitly mention the Korbanos because that would be a little bit of a bizayon for the Chag. Because Rosh Hashanah is a Chag, is a Yom Tov, and therefore it's a higher level of holiness. What's interesting is, I'll tell you a little bit of thing to ponder. I know that people don't memorize the Korbanos, it would be too much. But what's interesting is, the Korbanos of Rosh Chodesh are actually more numerous than the Korbanos of Rosh Hashanah. Again, if you look in Parshas Pinchas, for every Rosh Chodesh, you bring two parim, two bulls, one isle, one ram, and seven lambs, right? Two bulls, one ram, seven lambs, and one goat as a sin offering. Now, everything else is a burnt offering, and the goat is a sin offering. Now, you brought that on Rosh Hashanah too, according to Rabbeinu Tam. The extra Rosh Hashanah is one bull, one ram, seven lambs, and another goat. So it's exactly duplicative, except for the fact that instead of two bulls, you bring one bull. So the assigned korban for Rosh Hashanah is one animal less than the korbanos for Rosh Chodesh. It's interesting. The Sephorno actually gives us a reason why that's so. In fact, he has a whole mahalach on these korbanos. He says the bulls, which are big, powerful, strong animals, represent the intellect, the mind, and how we comprehend Hashem. And he says we normally comprehend Hashem through the use of two primal emotions, the emotion of yira, awe and reverence, and the emotion of ava, love. But since Rosh Hashanah is Yemei Din, the primary perception of Hashem is through yira more than ava, and that's why I said of the two bowls, we go down to one bowl. But nevertheless, you still brought the korbanos of Rosh Chodesh. And that's why you have that girsa, two goats for a sin offering. You may know, again, if you have to pay attention to that part, because one goat is part of the Rosh Chodesh offering, and one goat is part of the Rosh Hashanah offering. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, you should all have a Gemar Chasima Taiva, and good to Ben Shior, and to do a good year.
Thank you so much.